Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast. This is your host, E. Marcel Portute. Hope all of you are doing good out there. It's on a dreary, looks like it's going to be rainy Friday morning here in Atlanta, Georgia. Looks like it's not going to be a lot of sunshine outside. Kind of disappointing. Wanted to go outside and do some outdoor activities, but probably just have to head inside to the gym. But lots of activities to talk about in the world of sports, though. We're going to talk today's show. We're going to talk about the NBA playoffs. Have four game sixes going on tonight and had some series end since we've last spoken. Going to review the NHL playoffs, give my predictions for the first round. NHL playoffs started off on Tuesday. Going to talk about the Major League Baseball, go over each division, give my thoughts on each division race so far, and touch on the Cubs and Wrigley Field situation. We'll delve into that. Next, we'll talk about sexuality in sports. Big weekend, a week of that. We were supposed to talk about it last week, back with Brittany Griner, number one pick of the WNBA draft. And all of a sudden, Jason Collins, he made his announcement. So we have a lot more to talk about in relation to that. So we're going to go there. And then finally, we're going to end off with what's miscellaneous subjects. I'll give my podcast of the week. I'll give a little preview of the Floyd Mayweather-Robert Guerrero fight. Talk about some European soccer. And finally, the highly anticipated and long-awaited Ruffling My Feathers edition. And this one is going to be about my prom experience back when I was in high school. So you're going to want to stick around for that at the end. So once again, some housekeeping. We are brought to you by the Sports Inquirer podcast. Or the podcast is brought to you by the sportsinquirer.net, excuse me. And it's the premier site for news and notes in the world of sports. Also, we have a partnership with thestartinglineup.net. Excellent radio, internet radio broadcast based out of Chicago, Illinois. So we are happy to do work with them as well. And if you want to listen to archived shows, you can always subscribe to us on iTunes or head over to the website, once again, thesportsinquirer.net. You can go to Twitter as well under Sports Inquirer, all one word, and subscribe to us on there. And then finally, even on Facebook, just look us up on The Sports Inquirer. Those are all separate words. So I'm going to take our first break, and when we come back, we are going to review each of the NBA playoff series that are still going on so far here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. I tell you, this time of year is the worst for me, the best and the worst. It's the worst because I'm a man who's used to getting a lot of sleep. That's my lifestyle. I'm one of those guys who goes to bed around 11 p.m., wakes up around 7 a.m. You know, I tend to go to bed early and get up early, like take care of my business, you know, in the morning time. However, with these playoffs, especially with the West Coast games in the first round, there have been a lot of late evenings for me. Matter of fact, the Golden State-Denver game last night, I think ended around 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. So, and had woke up around 7 today. So it's not a lot of sleep, but it's the best time of year, though, because we got all of the playoff races, even some baseball, auto racing, mixed martial arts, and et cetera. But it's just not a lot of sleep going on for me, especially in the West Coast games. That's why I miss living in Nashville. Because, well, not only is it a great city and, you know, so I have some peoples there, but you get that central time zone, you get an hour different, so you actually save an hour while watching all of these contests. But, you know, that's the negative of living in the West, or the East Coast in Atlanta. But the games going on have been really exciting. And we'll start off with one series that's still going on. We're going to have our only game set. Well, currently our only game seven, and that's going to be the Chicago and Brooklyn series. Nets won last night, 95-92. This series has had everything you can possibly imagine. You had the epic triple overtime game four contest, where Nate Robinson channeled his inner Michael Jordan at the United Center. I've never heard the term plantar fasciitis spoken so much over in a playoff series. Obviously, Joe Johnson of the Nets and Joachim Noah of the Bulls, they're both dealing with that painful foot injury. We've had flus. I guess the Bulls, the Luol Deng and Nate Robinson and several other players, they have like a flu-like symptoms. And yeah, Nate Robinson throwing up on the sideline yesterday or on the bench. So this series has pretty much been about who can survive, survival of the fittest. And then we got Game 7 coming up on Saturday night in Brooklyn. Personally, I'm going to take the Nets to win it. The Bulls, from the Derrick Rose not being able to participate, really hasn't played all season. Him not being available and Luol Deng dealing with his injury issues, sounds like he's going through some serious stuff. They had to do, get some spinal fluid to check for meningitis. That's some major stuff there. And then Noah, he's hobbled. He's been playing hard, but he's hobbled. The Bulls just don't have enough horses to deal with the Nets, especially when the Nets are at home and you got Deron Williams going and Brook Lopez. That's going to be a really tough contest for them to win. But we got our first Game 7. We may have had a Game 7 in the next series, Golden State Warriors and Denver Nuggets. And it looked like we were heading towards that direction. Warriors end up winning Game 6, 92-88. And they're going to face the Spurs next in the conference semifinals. The Warriors dominated three quarters of this contest, especially the third quarter when Steph Curry went off and hit multiple three-pointers and they developed a double-digit lead. But the last 3-4 minutes, you saw so many turnovers by Golden State, especially in the backcourt. Curry was making bad throws. Jared Jack, who's the veteran of the squad, he was making bad turnovers. Just Klay Thompson had some issues. Really bad ball handling. But in the end, they're able to get the win. Andrew Bogut, who has been we've been a fan of here at the Inquirer for a while, very active in the social media, especially back in his days at Milwaukee, had his best playoff game of his career, probably the best game he's had in career's past few years. He's dealt with some leg injuries, had that nasty elbow injury when he was with the Bucks, and he's really struggled the past 2-3 seasons to stay on the court. But he had a playoff career high, 14 points and 21 rebounds in the win for the Warriors. And they are such an exciting team to watch. No disrespect to the Nuggets. George Karl's excellent coach, and they have a good team there. But the Warriors are such a fun team. They shoot a lot of three-pointers. And I'm envious. And there are not a lot of things I'm envious of. Living in Atlanta, you have some good opportunities here, good weather, people are good. But that Warrior crowd at Oracle Arena in Oakland, I am so jealous of that crowd atmosphere. And I just see so many of these other cities. Oakland with the Warriors, they have an excellent crowd. In New York with the Knicks, when the Knicks are going, that crowd gets hyped. The Bulls, when they're going, that Chicago energy is tremendous. And you just see it so lacking in Atlanta. I hope for the Hawks' sake that tonight in their Game 6, and we'll get to the Indiana-Atlanta series in a little bit, hopefully for Game 6 for the Hawks, they can have the good energy in that crowd for them. But Golden State, they're such a fun team to watch. They get the Spurs next. Really tough contest for him. Problem with that contest for him, Spurs have so much beef inside with Duncan and Tiago Splitter. And while Bogut has had a good series against the Nuggets, I think that's going to be too much for them to handle. Curry and Tony Parker, I think they're going to negate each other as far as the scoring goes. Ginobili and Klay Thompson, we're looking forward to that matchup. As well. But we'll see what happens with the Warriors. They've lost, 27 or 28 straight games in San Antonio. I will say this. I think that streak ends during this series. I think the Warriors win at least one game in San Antonio. So I'll say that streak ends, but it's going to be really tough to see them getting past the Spurs. But we'll get to that series a little bit more when we get closer to it. I think that series starts on Monday. Let's see. Next one. My Knicks, so disappointing over against the Celtics. Had a 3-1 lead. You have Game 5 at home. Celtics looks like they're on the ropes. J.R. Smith is talking that talk. Wearing all black, talking about funerals. Ain't going to end the Celtics season. And all of a sudden, they look terrible. They end up losing Game 5 to the Celtics at home, 92-86. Lack of energy, lack of inspiration. Carmelo Anthony playing 45 minutes, only going 8-for-24 from the field, 0-for-5 and three-pointers. J.R. Smith, the one who got stupidly suspended for Game 4 in the series, he ends up getting no point after to finish 3-for-14 in Game 5. Of that series. Just so much negativity as far as the Knicks go. And Mike Woodson talked about he didn't approve of all of the talk from J.R. Smith and Kenyon Martin, all the guys coming in black. You know, it's just one of those things where it's playoff time and you shouldn't... A lot, 99% of the time, and Charles Barkley has said it correctly, as far as bulletin board material, if you're a professional athlete and you need the motivation of another... your opponent talking smack or trash to you to get you hyped up for a game, then you're really in the wrong profession. I say the exception, though, is a team like the Celtics with those two veterans, Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett, who pride themselves on being the truest form of professionals, you know, out there. And while I think the Knicks are still going to win this series, matter of fact, I think the Knicks are going to pull off Game 6 tonight in Boston. I think they're going to win tonight's contest, but you know the Celtics aren't going to go out without a fight, even with their injury issues and everything like that. I was just disappointed in the Knicks because you're looking, if you're a team like New York, you're looking beyond, you shouldn't look beyond the first round, but you have championship aspirations, and honestly, that's what the Knicks have. I mean, they have a player in his prime in Carmelo Anthony. They have J.R. Smith having the best year of his career. You got veterans like Tyson Chandler and Jason Kidd, who are still playing at a high level. The Knicks may not have this type of squad for the next few years if those players start breaking down. Even with Amari Stoudemire, we see the inconsistencies with him. So the Knicks need to take advantage of the situation right now and at least get to the conference finals where they'll probably face Miami. So the Knicks need to be very careful and take advantage of this situation. And then finally, with that series, I talked about professionalism of Pierce and Garnett. Complete lack of that with the other side of the spectrum of the Celtics with that little fight at the end of the contest with Jordan Crawford talking to Raymond Felton and Carmelo Anthony and talking about what one of his talking to Carmelo Anthony about what one of his Celtics teammates may have done to his wife. Really inappropriate and unnecessary. It's something that we all know. If you're listening to this show, you know about the Kevin Garnett, Carmelo Anthony incident earlier this year when apparently Garnett talked about what maybe sexual situations Carmelo Anthony's wife has been in, and they had a big spat about that, but apparently they talked about it and they cooled off on it. But then Jordan Crawford, who's wearing warm-ups, such a scrub, no point in talking about, I'm giving him too much airtime right now, honestly, talking about him. And the audacity of him to talk crap to the Knicks players while he barely plays in the game and wearing warm-ups at the end, really stupid, you know, by him. But I understand the high energy of the playoffs and everyone's hyped and excited, but he's a scrub. He's a terrible player. I mean, he's a decent player. He's actually not a bad player. He had ups and downs with the Wizards back in Washington, and I think could be a solid contributor. But at this stage of the season, He has nothing to hold on to. So it was just, for comedy's sake, it was pretty funny. But he's a terrible player to be talking all that junk to him. So we'll see what happens in Game 6 tonight in Boston. Mentioned the Hawks and the Pacers. Indiana won Game 5, 106-93. Obviously, being our home base being here in Atlanta, the continual lack of maturity on the Hawks just continues to disappoint the fan base here, including myself. Then that Game 5, Jeff Teague, Ivan Johnson, Josh Smith all drew technicals on dead balls, and Josh Smith ended up being thrown out of the contest. And Josh Smith, at this stage of his career, has to realize that his importance on the court is mandatory for the Hawks to have any potential success in the playoffs. And we're all used to him taking a bad shot or two, or dribbling the ball up the court, trying to be the point guard, and turning the ball over. And it's not going to change at this stage. And he wants a max deal. That's not happening. And I expect he pretty much performed how I expected him to perform in this series. But the point is, you cannot get thrown out of a contest in a game, critical game five, when a series is tied at two and you're on the road. And furthermore, you know that if you win that game, you could possibly steal this series, because Indiana has lost 13 straight games in Atlanta. So if you get that 3-2 lead coming into the game tonight with an advantage, you can close out the series at home. So Josh Smith showed that immaturity once again. And it just seems like the Hawks, outside of Johnson and Al Horford, the lack of energy is so inconsistent with Atlanta. And I said, it's just frustrating to see that, you know, as a team, when you have Indiana, who honestly really should have won this series in five. They're on paper the much better team overall. Indiana's allowing the Hawks to hang in there, and we'll see what happens there in game six. And then finally, Oklahoma City and Houston, a lot of drama in this series as well. Houston won game five back on Wednesday, 107-100. James Harden had 31 points, finished 7 of 9 for three-pointers. The Thunder tried an interesting technique in the fact that in the fourth quarter, when they were down by double digits, they started doing the hack-a-sheek. We all know about the hack-a-shack. You start doing the intentional fouls early in the fourth quarter, get him to the line, miss free throws, shorten the game, get more possessions for yourself. And Ashiku, I think this season's been about 55 to 60% free throw shooter, ended up going 11 of 16 for free throws in the fourth quarter. And Shaquille O'Neal brought up a good point that postgame inside the NBA, obviously he is the expert on this situation. He said, when you start getting fouled so much, you develop a rhythm at the line, and it actually ends up backfiring on you if you're trying to do that, you know, to the opponent. So you saw that happen with Ashiq. He got a rhythm. He made a lot of free throws. But the biggest point, though, from Game 5 is Kevin Durant had 0 points in the fourth quarter. And while it's been easy to make fun of, or not make fun of, but critique the Thunder's miscues or losses on Russell Westbrook's over-aggressiveness, taking more shots than Durant, and maybe lapsing on defense at times, and getting technicals and having negative energy. While some of that is true, and there have been moments where those have happened, we're really seeing the value of Westbrook as being one of the top 10 players of the NBA and arguably the best point guard in the NBA. I mean, that's a big debate between him, Chris Paul, and Tony Parker, and so forth. But Russell Westbrook is in the argument for that, and we're starting to see him missing value, you know, in this series. But we've also seen the spotlight get more to Ibaka, and especially Durant. You can't be the elite player that Durant wants to be, and that we I think rightfully put him at as far as his scoring and his efficiency, and scored 0 points in a fourth quarter in a critical game five at home. You know, that can't happen. And I think we're starting to see really the media and the basketball fans kind of put the light on Durant. He can't hide under what, and not that he's hiding under Russell Westbrook and defers to him. So I think he does defer to him sometimes on the offensive end. But we're really starting to see the analysis of, okay, Westbrook's not here for us to critique anymore and to be negative about the bad moments for the Thunder. What are we going to get from Durant? And also with the schemes that the Thunder are trying to do with the point forward for Durant, while I'd like Durant having the ball more often, I don't know if that's the right style for him. I think you need to have him off the ball more often and let Reggie Jackson and Derek Fisher perform the point guard duties that the Thunder have established throughout the year. You go from having Durant play off the ball and run off screens on a consistent basis with Russell Westbrook handling the ball, and all of a sudden you're putting Durant in a completely different offensive format for him. So I'm interested to see what Scott Brooks does in Game 6 tonight in Houston. And also, I want to see what they do with that foul situation with Ashiq. I didn't like it, especially when he got the lead down to 5 points with about 5 minutes to go. You're in the contest. You don't have to keep fouling him. And I think that really got the Thunder out of rhythm as well. And you saw that with Durant getting no points in the fourth quarter and ended up losing by 7 to the Rockets, who I think are going to make, it's going to be a game 7. I think they're going to win tonight and get the series back to Oklahoma City and get a game 7 this weekend, especially with Harden doing well and Chandler Parsons. Beverly's been a revelation at the guard spot for the Rockets since Jeremy Lin's been out with the chest injury. So I think we're going to see a game 7 for that series. Atlanta, and we'll just go back, Atlanta and Indiana. I think the Pacers are going to win this game tonight. I think the Hawks blew their chance in game 5. I think the Pacers finally break that odd little losing streak they have in Atlanta and get that series win. And then New York and Boston, as I said, I think the Knicks get that one as well. They close that one out. So those are the thoughts I have so far. Oh, one last thing. I got to talk about the Clippers and Grizzlies. Game 6 in Memphis tonight. Grizzlies win that game by double digits. I just have no... I have a lack of faith. I'm not going to say no faith, but a lack of faith in the Clippers on the road. Just because while Chris Paul is doing everything that he can, the other players have struggled in this series so much on the offensive end. And then on defense, Gasol and Zach Randolph, who I've been not critical of, but kind of questioning his skill level the past few weeks. You saw towards the end of the regular season, he was kind of having below his standards as far as the productions of points and rebounds. He's back in his 20.10 rebound form, and he is doing work in the post along with Gasol, and the Clippers have no answer for that. So I think the Grizzlies end that series tonight. So those are my thoughts on the NBA playoffs. By the time we speak on our next show on Monday, we're going to have, I think all these series should be over by then, and then we're going to have our conference semifinals, and that's going to be some exciting times here on the network and for all of you out there. So we're going to take our next break, and when I come back, I'm going to delve into some NHL playoff action and some news about the upcoming NHL draft that is going to be interesting for, I think, the entire league and a continued evolution of the sport. Once again, here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. And with the NHL playoffs in full swing as well, we're getting some double overload of playoff action. With the first games, everyone's played at least one game so far in their series. Some have played two. Let's just run down, I'll give my predictions on each series as well. Let's start with the Western Conference. Chicago, number one seed against Minnesota, number 8. Interesting series here. I think you have a Blackhawks team, which is clearly the best team in the NHL, all season, with Taze and Patrick Kane and the goaltending of Emery and Crawford against a Wild team, you know, with Weber and Parisi at a, you know, the big contributions for the Wild. Blackhawks won the first game 2-1 in overtime. This one's going to go back and forth. Chicago, I think, ultimately wins it in 6, but I think the Wild are going to be a really tough little contest for them to deal with. So, not Weber, Bruce Sutter, my goodness. Sorry, Nashville peeps out there. I'm completely confusing my defenseman there. No, Sutter is the one that's is back, is with the Ryan Suter signed with the Wild in the offseason. So we're going to go to Chicago to win that one. Anaheim and Detroit, this one's going 7. Detroit, even despite being the 7th seed, with them, just their attack with Zetterberg and solid goaltending from Howard and their team. That was an odd game last night. The big lead that was blown by the Wings there. They had a big lead, had a 3-1 lead when I was watching it. The Ducks ended up tying it 4-4 and went to overtime. Nyquist had the game winner in overtime. So that series is tied at 1. I'm going to take the Ducks to win the series, but Detroit is a tough squad. Vancouver and San Jose, the 3-6 contest. I'm taking the Sharks in 6. I'm very bullish on San Jose. A really good team there. And I'm really bullish on maybe it's less on San Jose and more on the continued miscues of the Canucks, especially the goaltending situation between Roberto Luongo and Corey Schneider. They can never decide between these two guys all year, and you have Luongo in there for a little bit, and then Schneider, he's going to be in there also. And the Sedin twins, they outside of their run 2 years ago to make the Stanley Cup Finals, where they eventually lost to Boston, they have had their struggles in the postseason. I'm taking San Jose to win this one pretty handily. And finally, we have St. Louis and Los Angeles. St. Louis up 2-0 right now. They lose one game 2-1 in overtime, and they won last night 2-1 in regulation. The Kings, they've been down this road before, though. They, even last year when they won the Stanley Cup, they struggled on the road, or they struggled in the beginning of series in various contests. But in the end, I think St. Louis in the end is going to be too deep for them to deal with. So I'm taking the Blues to win this one. Now the Eastern Conference. We follow Eastern Conference a little bit more because my favorite team is in the Eastern Conference. But we talk about the West as well. But let's get to the East. The Islanders, I'm going to withhold my bias as a Rangers fan with the Islanders. If there's a series that could possibly be swept, this is the series here that's going to happen at. Pittsburgh is, even without Sidney Crosby, who's out with a broken jaw, or I guess a head injury, the Islanders just don't have enough. I mean, Nabokov, solid goalkeeper, veteran, but I just don't think the Islanders have enough outside of Tavares to provide much of an offensive threat against the Penguins, who are rolling right now on their offense and their power play. And they shut out the Islanders 5-0 in game 1 of that series to have a 1-0 lead. I don't think it's going to be 5-0 every contest, but the Islanders, that's going to be too much for them. I think an upset that can definitely happen is in the 2-7 series. Montreal, number 2 seed, Ottawa, number 7. Senators went into Montreal and got a 4-2 victory in game 1 of that series. Problem with Montreal, and Subban's been, I think they're going to be the Norris Trophy winner for the best defenseman. The goaltending with Price, he just has such inconsistencies. I think that's going to really hurt Montreal in the long run. A lot of these series, as if you're noticing a theme, a lot of it is goalkeeping and goaltending. And I just don't think that Price is going to be enough for Montreal to get him past Ottawa. And while I may be overreacting to the first game of the series, and there have been plenty of teams, especially in the NHL, who've lost the first game at home and ended up winning the series later on, I'm just concerned about Montreal right now. I think that the Senators are going to be a live underdog in that one as far as seeds go. Washington and New York, bad matchup for the Rangers. Washington's been maybe the hottest team in the NHL, or besides Pittsburgh, as far as in the last month or so. These teams seem like they've met 3 of the past 4 postseasons. Washington, I think, is going to be too much for the Rangers to handle overall. Rangers just don't have enough scoring, and I watch this contest quite a bit. When you have power plays, you can't go 0-for in your power plays, especially when you have a 5-on-3, and guys like Rick Nash are not taking the shots when they're supposed to, and not shooting enough. The Rangers they lack offensive weapons, but when your big dog isn't taking the shots to take advantage of the opportunity, especially when the Capitals are shorthanded, that's a recipe for disaster. And then the Rangers end up giving them 2 goals within a minute in the third period. That contest was over. I think Washington could definitely make a run to the finals with Ovechkin, who may be the Hart Trophy winner for as far as the MVP of a regular season. So I'm going to take the Capitals to win that one. Finally, Boston and Toronto. I really want the Maple Leafs to do well, not only for the fan base, but for the NHL overall. It's always good to have a major market Original Six team like the Maple Leafs do well. But they're facing the wrong squad in the Bruins, who, if anything, bring a physicality that is going to be too much for Toronto to handle. And the Bruins held serve at home and had a pretty convincing 4-1 victory in Game 1 in Game 1 of that series. So those are my thoughts as far as the NHL playoffs go. But off the ice, or this is related to the current outlook for the NHL, the teams that did make the playoffs had the lottery. First year that all of the non-playoff teams were eligible to win the lottery. Didn't know that while doing my research. But in the end, the Colorado Avalanche, a team out of Denver, won the lottery, and they're most likely going to take Seth Jones out of Portland of the WHL. Interesting story about Seth Jones. He's actually gained some traction, I think, in the mainstream media. Obviously, he's a black player, son of Popeye Jones. If you're an old NBA head like myself, you're familiar with Popeye Jones, who played for a multitude of teams over the years and is actually currently an assistant with the Brooklyn Nets, or I guess works with that staff. While Seth Jones actually got introduced to ice hockey when Popeye Jones, his father, was playing for the Denver Nuggets. There goes my Denver reference. I knew I had Denver in there somewhere. He was playing for the Denver Nuggets while the Avalanche were in the middle of their excellent Stanley Cup winning run when Joe Sakic was the captain. Sakic actually suggested that Seth Jones, start playing hockey. He picked it up, obviously, very well. And in the end, it looks like he's going to head back to Colorado to play his professional career. Really interesting situation in two fronts. Obviously, we've talked about the racial element of it. As I said, being a hockey fan, I don't really notice the lack of minorities, whether it's black players or Hispanic players or things like that in ice hockey. It really doesn't affect me as far as watching the game. I've been following the sport since I was a little kid. That and ice hockey and baseball were the two sports that I got into the most when I was younger. So I've always had love for hockey and never looked at the black players. It feels like a Jerome Iginla or a Greer or some other guys or Weeks, and look at them as like, oh man, there's a black guy. Yes, I got to support him and he's got to represent. It really doesn't affect me personally, but I'm not a dummy as far as the marketing opportunities that this could present to the NHL and presenting the brand to another group of people who may not traditionally be ice hockey fans. The businessman in me loves this, not only for the sport, but for the entire league. As far as some people say, okay, wow, there's a black player out there. Maybe I don't watch hockey, but not only is he a black player, but he's going to be a really good one. And no matter what race Jones is, he has talent to be a superstar defenseman, in the league. And that's where it kind of hurts a little bit too, because his style of play may not be. It reminds me of David Beckham in a way, not the racial aspect, but the style of play aspect, when Beckham came over to the Los Angeles Galaxy. And when he signed with them, my first thought was the average non-hockey fan or non-soccer fan is not going to really appreciate his style of play. It'd be better, I thought Beckham, if he was a goal scorer, it was like a Lionel Messi style, a Cristiano a Ronaldo style of player, where he dribbled the ball through various players, scored a lot of goals. That'd bring a level of excitement to the game that non-fans can appreciate. Because no matter what sport you watch, you can appreciate scoring. In whatever sport you watch, whether it's football, hockey, whatever, you appreciate put the ball in the net or score a basket or score a touchdown or whatever. You understand that and appreciate that. But the subtleties of a David Beckham, who is an excellent creative midfielder and obviously strong free kicker, I didn't think that would translate well to fans who, in the end, watch a game and say, oh, Beckham didn't do anything. He just ran around and he didn't score any goals. He didn't have any trickery. But obviously, the soccer fans who are football fans who appreciate the subtleties of controlling the pace of the game from the midfield obviously knew the worth of Beckham and appreciate his style of play. Same thing's going to happen with Jones as far as a defenseman. He's not going to be a 50-goal scorer. He is not going to lead the league in scoring or have highlight reel like Ovechkin-type moves or Malkin-style going through three, four players, scoring on a backhand or, you know, that's not going to be a style of play. He's going to control the blue line, be the point man on a lot of power plays, and just control the flow of play. Now, as a hockey fan, I appreciate an excellent defense play, and I see the importance of that. But I think if you're going to see a guy him come into the league and expect him to be a 40, 50-goal scorer, that's not going to happen. So it's interesting to see how it's going to be marketed as far as his style of play. And then finally, don't rule out Jay-Z. I'm calling it right now. He's going to have some presence in the man's in Seth Jones' career. I mentioned the Popeye Jones Nets connection. Jay-Z, we know, has the rapper, business mogul, is already dipping his toes into becoming a player representative with Robinson Cano and Victor Cruz, respective players for the New York Yankees and New York Giants. Jay-Z is going to put his foot into hockey as well, especially with Seth Jones. So I'm looking forward to seeing how that happens. That's my prediction. It may not happen, but I think you're going to see a very hip-hop, younger demographic approach when it comes to Jones and how he's going to promote the game. But I'm excited for him, and Colorado's a good market. He's going to be comfortable there with Joe Sackett bringing it full circle. He's in the front office of the Avalanche. So that's going to be a really exciting time for him and the league. So those are my thoughts so far on the NHL. I haven't really delved into too much ice hockey since we've been doing the podcast, so much respect to NHL and all the few of you out there who really enjoy ice hockey. Hope you enjoyed my commentary on it. So we're going to take our next break here, and when I come back, I'm going to give my thoughts on Major League Baseball. I was doing my outline. I was going to do a power ranking like we did on Pick a Podcast or two ago as far as ranking my top 10 teams overall. But I think we're going to change a different approach now. Most teams have played close to 30 games so far in a major league season. So I'm just going to go over each division and give my analysis, kind of what I see in the overall landscape of each of the division races so far. We'll start off with the AL East. Boston holds a 2.5 game lead over the Yankees. So far, Boston with the MLB best 20-8 record, best run differential in the entire league. They have a run differential of plus 49, the closest competitor they have in all of baseball. No one else is even at plus 30, unless the Rockies are at plus 29, and that's it. So the Red Sox have a run differential of plus 49, which is 20 runs more than any other team in baseball. And that's all due to the pitching and the surprising hitting as well, with Middlebrooks and Mike Napoli have been doing, even David Ortiz has come back and contributed and put some runs up for the Red Sox. I picked the Red Sox to finish last in the division, so obviously my prognostication skills are not at the peak right now. But if they continue to get pitching by their top three dogs, which is Clay Buchholz, John Lester, and even Ryan Dempster, who had a nice outing last night as well, if they can get good contributions from those three guys and their bullpen, which has been doing really well, and get Bailey at the back end, Red Sox are going to win this division and make a noise in the playoffs if they can keep it going for the entire year. Now, obviously, between Lester and Buchholz, injury concerns are strong, and Dempster, he's an older pitcher as well. So you got to watch out for them as far as the arms holding up. But right now, I think the Red Sox have been the biggest surprise in a positive way in all of baseball. Interesting division race, though. The Yankees and the Orioles at 17 wins each. I picked Baltimore to win the division, so I think they're still within striking distance as well. Tampa, 12-15, a little bit surprising there that they're struggling so much. Their pitching has not been the same this year. And then Toronto, 10-19. They have their run differential is minus 44. They've given up 150 runs this season, which I think is officially the most runs by far given up by all of me. Oh no, the lowly Astros. We'll get to them later on. They have given up the most runs at 168 so far this year, but Toronto has the second most at 150. R.A. Dickey, outside that start that he had in Kansas City earlier this year, he's struggled. Burley and Johnson, the former Marlin pitchers, they haven't brought much to the table. Jose Reyes, he's out with a leg injury. Just struggles for the Blue Jays overall. They may finish in last. I mean, I didn't think they finished this low, but they have a lot of ground to make up even early. Let's get to the AL Central. Kansas City, 15-10. They're in first place, tied with Detroit, who's 16-11. I don't think the world is going to hold this up. They struggle to score runs. Their pitching has actually been pretty darn decent, but they're going to struggle to keep up the offensive pace. But right now, they're in first place. Detroit, I think, in the end, obviously with Verlander, Prince Fielder, Miguel Cabrera, and the various pitchers they have, they're going to win the division. But good to see Kansas City get off to a decent start, you know, as well, at 15-10. AL West, well, we'll start with the bottom. The Astros, 8-21, minus 50 run differential. They currently have a three-game losing streak. Really big struggles for the Astros moving over to the American League. I knew it'd be a struggle for them to do well, and they really are struggling. But then the team, they're actually only two games worse than the Anaheim Angels, who are 10-18 right now. The Josh Hamilton struggles are well documented, and obviously Mike Trout, he's getting into form a little bit right now, and Albert Pujols, he's not always the quickest starter to a season, but their pitching staff, just they're in major trouble with that. Between Weaver being out to injury, CJ Wilson not contributing as much as they would want, major struggles, you know, for the Angels at 10-18. Currently, the Rangers lead the division 17-11, and those pesky A's at 16-13, only 1.5 games behind the Rangers. Let's move over to the NL East, and what I think is going to be the most fun race with division wise in all of baseball between the Braves and the Nationals. Currently, matter of fact, the Braves just wrapped up a series with the Nationals. They split it 2-2 here in Atlanta. But right now, Atlanta has a 2.5 game lead over the Nationals. Both of these teams are predicted to make the playoffs. I picked the Nationals to actually win the division. But that Steven Strasburg injury really concerned. He's not injured. Yeah, I guess he has a stiffness in his forearm. I watched that start that he had against the Braves. I believe it was Tuesday night. He didn't look completely right in that entire start. The velocity was okay. He gave up some walks, but he ended up getting out of a lot of jams. But you could just see him shaking his arm multiple times, and he just looked uncomfortable out there. And while, as I stated in earlier in podcast, I've played amateur doctor so many times over my life, and seeing how God's body language is and overreacting to certain things, but even certain guys like Curt Schilling, I was watching ESPN watching Baseball Tonight, even he mentioned it as well during the analysis of the game, where he just saw his arm. It just didn't look like it was working well. So overall, I'd be concerned with them as far as that goes. And the rest of the division, got Philly, the Mets, and the Marlins really closing that out. Not much really to talk about there. I'll spare you the Mets update. They've actually, 11-15, they're kind of what I expected them to be. And let's just wrap it up real quickly. We got the NL Central, St. Louis, and Pittsburgh kind of holding their own with that. St. Louis has a one-game lead over the Pirates. Pirates at 16-12, trying to finish over .500 for the first time in a long time. Cincinnati, 15-14, a little bit disappointed in them. I mean, it's still early in the season, but I thought they would win this division pretty handily. But obviously, St. Louis, as always, they're so pesky, you can never get rid of them. And you know that even when they have a potentially looking like it's going to be a down season, they come back and continue to play well. And then finally, let's get to the NL West. Probably the second most surprising team so far, besides in all of Major League Baseball, besides Boston, the Colorado Rockies at 17-11. They have a one-game lead over the San Francisco Giants, who are 16-12. Rockies really doing it, obviously, you know, with the production on offense. They have a league-high 148 runs scored so far. Matter of fact, they have a major league-high. They're second most. But they have a second most at 148. But they lead the National League in runs scored at that total. Run differential plus 29. If they can have mid-level pitching, they're going to contend, I think, in the NL West. So far, they are doing pretty well as there. And finally, I just want to touch on real quickly the Chicago Cubs Wrigley Field situation. Ownership and management of the Cubs want to incorporate a digital scoreboard into Wrigley Field and make other amenity improvements to the stadium. But the Chicago residents, the owners of those houses or apartments outside of Wrigley Field, they actually charge a fee to watch Cub games. They're not having any part of it because that's cutting into their business. I think this shows an overall situation of why the Cubs have the ineptitude they have had over the past 100 years or so. A lot of people like to talk about curses and all of the bad karma with the goats and things like that. It's been crappy ownership and a general management ship who has never understood how to produce a winner at a consistent level. There are no excuses for them to be as bad as they've been over the years. And then when you see situations like these fans, which people clinging on to that Wrigley Field nostalgia of just showing up during day games and having a few drinks and enjoying the sunlight while you have a crappy team on the field, I've never understand why people would allow that to happen as far as the bad baseball play there. So they need to figure out that situation quickly if they want to move on as a franchise overall. I've personally never been to Wrigley Field. I don't hold it to a high esteem as some other people do. I love to head up there. I'm trying to head up to Chicago in the summer for business. And if I do head up there, I definitely will try to swing there and at least get a visual of it. Maybe attend the game. You never know. But I don't understand people holding on to these stadiums so much. I understand like Dodger Stadium and Fenway Park and Wrigley. I understand people wanting to enjoy the presence of the stadium and go to a landmark. And it is a landmark. I'll give it that respect. But I think that backward style of thinking really hurts your program in the long run. So send me your thoughts on that and the Cubs situation. And obviously send me an email at sportsinquire@gmail.com. Or shoot me a comment when you go to our website, thesportsinquire@.net. So send me some information there, and we'll be able to get some dialogue going with that as well. When I come back, we're going to talk about sexuality in sports and some recent announcements of current active basketball players and their sexual preferences and how the media covered it here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. and arguably the biggest sports story off the field as far as this year of 2013. Jason Collins, who is an NBA free agent, about 10-year veteran of the NBA, he announced that he is gay in the cover story of Sports Illustrated this past week. If you're listening to the podcast, you've heard about it, and you know the whole situation, and I'm not going to delve into as far as the specifics of it, but you know what the deal is with that. And also Brittany Griner, the WNBA first overall pick, she for the Phoenix Mercury, she announced that she is a lesbian as well. Well, she announced it before the draft took place. So both of these players, high profile in their respective sports, announced their sexual preferences. Obviously, we here at the Sports Choir podcast, or just me personally, you know, me as an individual, been very pro the gay and lesbian transgender lifestyle. My staff, but just, you know, talking on a personal level, have friends and people, you know, who are gay and lesbian, no problems with that at all. I'm very happy for both of those players on a personal level that they were able to express themselves and have not received too much backlash. You're going to have your handful of people who don't like it, and we'll get to some in particular with it. My analysis, though, is going to be on the media reaction to the announcement and not the announcement itself. So, an interesting take on a lot of the media outlets. Obviously, one of these type of stories, it has that crossover appeal. Whenever you have a situation like this, I always said, and my barometer is always Good Morning America or CNN. We'll stick with a Good Morning America analysis. If you're the lead story on Good Morning America and it's a sports related, 9 times out of 10 is not for a good situation. Usually it's about a big fight or something in a violent nature, an arrest, things like that. But the minute I knew the story was announced, it was like, okay, this is going to be the main story. And George Stephanopoulos, who, you know, is a big-time journalist, got that first exclusive interview on camera with them. I knew that was going to be in the works immediately. And obviously the story now, Jason Collins is going to talk to Oprah. So, you know, he's official right now as far as becoming a mainstream known guy. Because when you talk to Oprah, that's the big time. But I thought the media handled it pretty well as far as not being, just really stating the facts of it. There's really not much of a story to it. As far as you look at it, you have a man who has been in the NBA for, I think, 12, 13 years. He's been a solid role player, and even he'll admit it. He's played on multiple teams, and he just announced his sexual preference on the premier sports magazine in the world. And I think people just acknowledged it and said, okay, he made the announcement. You know, he's a free agent. He's going to try to play again next season. Even before the announcement, I had a feeling he would get signed by somebody, because while he doesn't produce a lot of points and rebounds, he's a good locker room leader. He's a bench player. He gives you about 5-10 minutes per contest. If anything, he has 6 fouls, you know, for him to give to any post player. So he's a solid role player. He's going to really get signed now, though, I think, as far as not only on 2 levels. One, he's still a productive player. 7-footers are hard to find that can actually produce and have their head together on the court. So I knew he'd get a shot there. But I think he's going to get an opportunity. You can't tell a team to sign somebody. I don't think the NBA offices can say, or David Stern, the commissioner, can say, hey, Team X, you have to sign him. But I think there's going to be an effort to make sure that he's not on, and make sure he's on a roster this season just for PR purposes. But I don't think it'll be just because, oh, for PR. He actually can play. So we'll see what happens with that. But I thought the media did an okay job overall talking about it and trying to keep their biases out of it, except when it came to ESPN and Chris Broussard. When he was on Outside the Lines, he stated that, and you can look up the quote, and as I said, if you know the story, you've heard his thoughts on it. In essence, he said Jason Collins' lifestyle, he considers it a sin as a Christian. Personally, I'm a Christian as well, and I have no problem with his lifestyle, and I don't want to turn this into a religious debate and what the Bible says about homosexuality. There are people who are more of an expert on that than I am to really delve into that topic a little bit further. Personally, I just don't understand, as I'll say this, my one blanket statement. I don't understand as a Christian how you can, especially as a black man, how you can be unaccepting of another person because of their sexuality. I would just think as a black man, you would understand the prejudices that all people go through in the society, whether you're a man or a woman or your different religions or your skin color. I would just think as someone who deals with that on a personal, professional level in some form, that you would not carry the biases that you deal with over to somebody else who's dealing with or who has maybe a sexual preference that is not common or not common. That's not the right way to say it. That maybe is not as accepted as others. So that's my personal opinion on it. My point being, though, I don't understand why ESPN as a medium allowed him to express that and why he allowed himself to go there with it. And I just think, it's that ESPN mentality of let's get a debate going. And it was just so typical. It's like, okay, let's get a black homosexual, and then let's get someone who we know is not going to have a preference towards that. I just don't understand, you know, why they continue to delve themselves so low, you know, into that. And then finally, just to touch on it as far as the media goes, I think the beauty of living in 2013, you know, as well in relation to this, is Twitter. Twitter is such a great, internet is the overall arcing one, but Twitter as well. I love the fact that I actually found out about the story on Twitter. I didn't have to watch the local news or watch one of the sports networks to find out about it. I just went straight, saw Twitter. I go to SI.com quite often, so I mean the story was there, and I was able to read the story and see all about it and get as much information as I felt that I needed. It got a little bit of overkill, though. I think it's starting to die down right now. But it was like that 2-3 days with just too much Jason Collins, overkill. But I'm glad that we have the internet, because this is giving me an opportunity to speak to all of you right now. But furthermore, I think that we're starting to see a generational shift. This is my final point on it. As far as the media goes, we saw some older media members like Tim Brando and Mike Francesa not express disapproval, I think, necessarily in Collins' lifestyle, but just in the coverage of it and saying, why is this guy considered a hero or I don't care and whatever. I think that their ages, and I enjoy both of their shows. You know, honestly, I enjoy one more than the other. I won't tell you which one I enjoy more, but I enjoy, I mean, I respect both of them. They're longtime media professionals, and obviously being in the radio industry, you know, they've had a good careers in it. But I think you're starting to see a generational shift as far as coverage and as far as where people are finding their sources. I think you saw the people that are most vocal in support of Collins. It was a younger generation, and Griner to a lesser extent. She got less attention than Collins did, but still in, you know, the same ilk or same, it's still in the same stratosphere as far as, you know, sexuality and sports. I think you're starting to see some younger, and I say younger, I think you're starting to see about 40, and I'm 32, and so you're starting to see people for the 40 and under age group, you know, starting to realize that I don't need to just set my opinion based on what older people are. They don't set the tone for what I think and what my expression is. So I think that's where you saw a lot of people, even like myself and others, we just put our opinion out there, support or even disapproval. And now I'll end on this. Even with my disagreement with Broussard's opinion, I don't think he should be suspended, he should be fired, or anything like that. People are saying, oh man, they should suspend him from ESPN, or he is a grown man and has the right to express his opinion. I don't like when people they want to practice freedom of speech and It's like, oh yeah, we should be able to say whatever and express ourselves. And this isn't a liberal or conservative angle. It's both sides. I talk about this, like, we should have freedom of speech and say what we want or live our lives. But then when someone has an opposite opinion, you're just like, oh, I don't want to hear that. They should be suppressed. You know, they need to be reprimanded for their opinions. Freedom of speech goes both ways, whether you're for something or against something. So, but even if you have your opinions of whatever situation, your right to express that as an individual, you have to grant that to others as well. So as I said, I don't want Tim Brando to be reprimanded by his employer, or Chris Broussard to have to do a long handwritten apology or do a video apology expressing his opinions. I mean, those are grown men, those are individuals, and they have their thoughts on what they feel about it. And by all means, they should be able to express it, especially when it's their jobs in those forums to express their opinions of it, even though it may be contradictory in a way of what most of us are thinking or may not be thinking. So those are my thoughts on the coverage of the media's coverage of Brittany Griner and Jason Collins, you know, discuss their, I guess, announcements or statements of their sexuality. We're going to delve into this topic a little bit more over time, because I think it's a topic that I think is really going to, it's maybe the top, the sports outside the line, the sports topic off the field of 2013. We, in the past, we've had gambling be the story, steroids, things like that have been the stories that outside of the game have really been the thing that's been affected, you know, what we just discussed the most. I think sexuality is going to be the biggest one of 2013 without question, especially when the NFL season starts, and there have been some inklings about some gay players in the NFL and rumors along with that. I'm not going to say who the rumors have been about. I mean, you can go on the internet and search those out. But I think it's going to be that big issue that we're all going to be talking about in 2013. And I think it's good. It's good to have some open dialogue about a topic that people are either too scared to talk about or even acknowledge. But I enjoy it. I think it's a good, a necessary dialogue that's needed for all of us. So we're going to take our last break here. And when I come back, I'm going to talk about some miscellaneous news and notes in the world of sports. And as promised, my prom story here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. I told y'all I was going to go through my progressive rock phase, and right now we are feeling some Yes with Parallels with my boy Chris Squire on bass writing that song. That's one of my favorite Yes songs ever, so I had to get some Parallels in there for you. So let's just send some miscellaneous news and notes in sports outside of the main topics we discussed. Floyd Mayweather is going to defend his title against Robert Guerrero on Saturday. Floyd's going to put work in. He's going to dominate that guy. All the talk about, it's really just hyping up the fight. You've seen Guerrero's father talking about Floyd Mayweather being he's a woman beater, and if you heard the press conference and Oscar De La Hoya kind of saying, no, let's not go there. He's loving every moment of that. You know, Mayweather, obviously he's had a documented past, and I mean, he's had to serve time for domestic abuse issues. I mean, that's public record. But Guerrero really, you know, the father talking about it, and you know, going for those low blows, but it's boxing promotions. There's no, man, people will talk about their mother in a negative way to promote a fight, so That doesn't surprise me at all, but I think he's going to put in work on Guerrero. I'm honestly not too familiar with Guerrero's work as a fighter, so I think Mayweather, just going on experience and skill, he should handle him pretty easily. An upset would be intriguing, though, you know, just for something different. Leslie, we've finalized the Champions League final. It's going to be all German final in the for the UEFA Champions League. They're going to play on May 23rd, I believe, and they're going to be playing in London. And it's going to be Bayern Munich versus Borussia Dortmund. Both of those teams dominated their Spanish foes in the semifinals. I personally don't like all country finals. Like, I didn't want to see Real Madrid and Barcelona in the final. I like to see some different matchups, just some to see a contrast. I like seeing when it's Arsenal or Barcelona or Man United and Madrid. You know, just two different teams going at it, or Chelsea and, you know, whoever. You know, I just like seeing the two different countries going against each other, and we just don't get to see that in this one. But I think it really shows the rise of German soccer. You saw it a few years ago when they hosted the World Cup and ended up finishing in third place, that the German youth leagues, or the youth players, were really elevating their play with the... And Jurgen Klinsmann had a good part to do with that, and he's currently the coach of the United States men's national team. Hopefully he can bring some of those training skills and expertise and get the United States to a high level on an international level. But you saw that happen about 6-8 years ago with that, with them doing better. And then the Bundesliga has really improved their play. More finances are into it. They have a really good structure as far as giving players time off to rest. And right now it's a really big wave of German soccer. We've seen a big wave of Spanish soccer over the past 4 years, or really 6 years. They've won the Spanish national team has won two European Cups and the World Cup back in 2010. And you saw the rewards of that with Barcelona and Real Madrid, and they've had their run. But I think that run, I won't say it's ending, and that's the thing about those squads. I was reading an article about, is this the end of the line for Barcelona? It is not. Well, first of all, Lionel Messi, who's had an injury-filled past few months, he's only 25 years old. He has another 4 or 5 years of peak performance in him. And secondly, Barcelona has become like the Yankees or the Lakers. They're going nowhere for two reasons. One, they have the finances to keep up with the Joneses as far as international money goes, as far as getting training the best players and then transfer fees to pay for the best. And secondly, it is a place where people want to play. If you're an elite soccer player at the highest level, you want to play in Barcelona. You want to play for Real Madrid. You may want to start playing for Bayern now. They have a storied history, you know, in Munich. You want to be in the run of playing at a Manchester United or even a PSG over in France now, as the French league has actually made some improvements. In Italy, you know, you want to play for one of the Milan teams, AC Milan or Inter. There are certain squads that, as a player, you want to make your mark at, and Barcelona is right there. So they're not going to go anywhere. Some of the players are getting a little older. They'll replace them or transfer them out. So I don't think you're going to see the end of them. And Real Madrid, same deal. Richest club in the world. It's between them and Manchester United as far as the richest team in the world. They flip-flop back and forth. But, I mean, Real Madrid is right there as well. They're going nowhere. The all-whites, they are going to have their... They're going to be around for a long time. And then finally, I want to do my podcast of the week, and I'm going to do a little bit better this time. Last week, and we're going to make it this week as well, is the Joe Rogan Experience. And I'm really Joe, he's the experience is the inspiration for this podcast. I'm a fan of his work, his stand-up comedy, and also of his commentary of the UFC. I heard he had a podcast, and I was like, oh, it's a podcast. I never heard of one before. He was the first podcast that I actually downloaded and subscribed to on iTunes, and he has a free-flowing style of conversation. It's him and a guest. Well, it's him and then Brian Redman, who's his producer / co-host, and then they have a guest in every time they do the show. Actually, I remember back when, about 3 years ago, when they were, it was only on Skype, and they had no guests. It was just them two shooting the breeze. But now they have a lot of major guests on there. Main ones are usually Joey Diaz, Bert Kreischer, Ari Shaffir, the whole Def Squad group. They have like a little group, Duncan Trussell, can't forget about him. Tom Segura. They have like a group of guys, group of comedians. They do a lot of shows together and everything like that. But he's also had some major guys in other fields. He's had Graham Hancock, Christopher Ryan. He's had physiologists on there, a lot of scientists. Because while the show does talk about comedy, a little bit of sports. I mean, he's had MMA guys. And that was really their initial purpose. I was like, listening for MMA purposes. I was like, man, let's get some fighters on there. He's had a few. He's had Josh Barnett on there. And Boss Rutten did a show about a month ago, the legendary MMA commentator and fighter. And George St. Pierre just did a show a few weeks ago. So he's had MMA guys and athletes on there. But 90% of the time, it's usually someone on a scientific level. They talk a lot about evolution, a lot about space, and a lot about nature and science. And it's really exciting for me to open my mind up to a lot of that stuff that I'm not familiar with. And that said, now, Christopher Ryan, he has a good book, Sex at Dawn, that I'm really intrigued by and started reading. He's had a lot of, and you go down the list, I really recommend that you go on the JoeRogan.net. I'm going to shoot him a free plug there. Head over to the site, see all of the guests on there that he's had. It's really good content and discussion. Incorporates a lot of video there as well. A little bit mad at the video part, because a lot of times I listen to it while I'm on the gym on my iPod. And I don't have a video player, obviously, on the iPod while I'm doing my workout. But there's also options online. You can go to YouTube or just look it up on the little Ustream and check it out there. So JoeRogan.net or the Joe Rogan Experience, the podcast, I recommend that you check that out. And maybe if you hear his show, you'll understand the inspiration for this show. So we're going to end our show now with What's Ruffling My Feathers This Week. So this past weekend, my niece is graduating high school in a few weeks, actually. She had her senior prom. And I'm not going to go, there was some drama with it. It's family business. I'm not going to go there with it. But she had a good time and everything like that. Nothing major. But her prom experience reminded me of my prom back in 1999. Yeah, I'm that old out there. And also, it brought it full circle, too, because I'm actually heading over out to New York in a few weeks, and we'll talk about that I'm going to be in New York for all of next week, and we're going to do some shows from there and everything. But anyway, I'm heading back to my high school. We'll have a big reunion there. So between Jordan's prom, my niece's prom, and my return to New York City, it brought up my prom experience. So back in 1999, not the most socially active guy out there. In essence, I did not have a date for prom. Biggest problem was is that I was the student council president of my school, and I went to an all-boys school, so what we had to do is I actually had to plan the prom with four or five other schools so we could have like a mass prom. It was Browning, Collegiate, Spence, Hewitt, all these other girls' schools. We had to do a mass prom at one location. So as student council president my whole senior year, I had to plan this prom for an event that I'm not even going to have a date to. Honestly, if I had my choice, I would have not even gone to the prom. But I had to go because I was the president of my school. I was planning this whole thing, getting prom checks and dealing with all of that drama. I was like, well, I have to go to this prom and just deal with the consequences. I'm proud in one way that I went alone, because I did not want to pay for a ticket for some girl I just met and had to force myself to go with somebody I barely knew, which one or two of my friends had to do. I'll leave their names out, but they know who they are. And they barely knew these girls, and they took them to the prom. So anyway, I got dressed up, had the tuxedo and all that stuff. went to the prom. The event actually was not that bad. If anything, I spent my time mocking others and dealing with their girlfriends and all these people they didn't know. So the prom was okay and whatever, but at the end, I was cool during the actual prom, but then when the prom ended and everyone went to their after-hour parties and stuff like that, that was probably the loneliest I've ever felt in my life. I was like, man, all these people are out there with their boyfriends and girlfriends going out to some houses or some house parties or whatever, and I had no one to go with. And it was really a sad moment. Oh, and it gets better. So in the end, I was just standing there all alone and whatever. And then my boy Curtis, who I lost touch with, I need to catch up with Curtis. He actually had a post-prom party at his house. And it was like, hey, man, you should come to our place. We were already in Manhattan. So I was like, sure. So we shoot up there, over to his place. And I'm the only one there without a date. And the music's playing and everyone's all happy and stuff. Thank goodness there was wine there, though. So that was my first dalliance into wine. I mean, I was drinking the 40s and the liquor, you know, with my boys JP and Carlos. So I knew about alcohol. That wasn't the problem. But I learned about wine that night, and that was an interesting experience. So I'm at this party, all alone, drinking the wine. Parents are there. I hope I'm not putting his business out of it. The parents were there. They were enjoying the wine as well, and everything like that. But in the end, it's around 1 or 2 o'clock, and I'm like, all right, I need to head home. So I actually end up, I should have done it G'd up and keep it real and taking the subway home, which is what I used to always do in my dalliances. I ride the subway 3, 4 in the morning. I didn't give a crap. But in the end, I end up taking the yellow taxi back into Brooklyn and rode it over the bridge, Williamsburg Bridge, and back home. And that experience, actually, even talking about it right now, was back in the day, it was actually pretty painful dealing with that and say, man, because you build up the prom so much in your mind, even if you try to be cool about it and say, oh man, I'm not going to let it affect me. It's just another party. I've gone to different parties before. It's just, you know, we're all dressed up and whatever. There's so much emphasis put on the prom as an individual. Or by society and others, you see so many movies about it, and it's like, oh man, you're gonna have your first experiences in alcohol or drugs or sex or whatever, and you put so much pressure on yourself. It's like, man, I need to get my prom moment. And then later on, over the years, when you would see other people, I would see other people talk about their proms and their partners and how they had such a fun time going to different parties and houses and houses on the beach or on the shore and stuff like that. A lot of that happened in New York, obviously, with the water. But in the end, you know, I realized a few years ago that, and it kind of translates to what you are in life as well, you can't let the experiences of others and their paths really affect you. And as I said, that prom experience does represent a metaphor for my biggest shortcoming as an individual. And that's it's not jealousy or envy, but it's just comparing I guess the definition of it is, I'm gonna say it right now, it's comparing myself to others and their lifestyles. And I'm guilty most of looking at Facebook and even Twitter, seeing other people through their paths. They have, like, when they have their children, me thinking internally, when am I going to have a child, or seeing them married? It's like, am I ever going to get married? Am I ever going to have children? Am I ever going to be in a happy relationship? You know, you deal in the deep stuff like that, or professionally and career-wise, and you say, man, he just got a promotion, or they got a new job. Why am I still stuck at this spot? And, you know, things like that. But I think talking about that prom experience and learning about accepting what I have, and I can laugh at it now. It used to be a very sensitive subject, and I would never bring it up to people. But now when everyone talks about proms and stuff, it's like, what was yours like? I give them the whole real uncensored story of going there alone and feeling sad and depressed and really feeling like it was a low moment of my high school life. And I'm cool with that now, because that's just an experience in your life, and it's unique to you. And you just have to accept that as something that happened and take advantage of it. And if you can't laugh at yourself or look at yourself in a completely honest way, then you can't grow as an individual. So while I was seeing my niece prepare for her prom and dealing with all of that stuff, it brought me back to my time. And if anything, I was happy for her to have her experience with it. And I was also, in the end, happy for the experience I had in mine as well. Once again, thank you for listening to the Sports Inquirer podcast on the Sports Inquirer Network. We will be doing our next show on Monday. And on that show, we're going to continue talking about the NBA and NHL playoffs. We're going to talk about, give a review of that Floyd Mayweather fight. And then also talk about Major League Baseball. And if there are any other topics you want me to talk about, all of you have been pretty good on LinkedIn suggesting that I talk about either soccer or NHL playoffs. I enjoy getting all feedback, so shoot me an email at sportsinquirer@gmail.com or subscribe to us on iTunes under The Sports Inquirer. And until then, all of you have a safe, productive, fun, and good weekend out there.